we might as well get going.
All right. So, everybody, if you didn't get your quiz, I got your quiz, the old stuff, so you can pick it up, and makeup exams that people had. Welcome back from spring break. Very hardy back in the role again, but like that dog on that video I sent you, did you like that? It's like, work smart, you know, get it going. Try to really focus next 6 weeks, because really the majority of your grade is still out there, right? You've got the second exam, and then you have the final exam, right? So that's a lot of lecture content in the next 6 weeks. But remember what happens in, let's see, today is 19th, right? I think, yes. And then we have the 21st, Thursday. And then what happens next Tuesday? Quiz day. Why do we do quiz days? To get you ready so you don't study the night before for major exams. And then what happens? Then we have Thursday. And then what happens that following week? We start with some exams, right? So if you have that exam, if you have lab on the 1st, April the 1st, it's not a joke. It's not April Fool's Day. It's real. All right. That we actually have the lab. People will start to, you'll take your test in the lab, right? So we don't have labs that you have to do that week. But instead, you have that lab time to take your exams. And we're making up different exams for all the different sections, the four different sections. So what does that do? It helps decrease the stress of that time frame. But also it gives us more time to have open response questions and pull out of your mind what's inside there. And I think it's actually a lot easier for you. Usually people do better on an open response question than, you know, just a multiple choice if you don't know the answer, because you can kind of guess. But we don't want a brain dump, right? We want, you know, right to the point. So hopefully this will help. And then some of the multiple choice questions help you with the open response answers, right? But if there's a blank, it could be a blank if you don't know it, right? So you can't, like, choose, you can't guess. You can't just put A, B, and C. There's no A, B, and C. We do get sometimes people writing IDK, which I figured out what that means now. I don't know. So that's okay, but you don't get any extra credit for that. So definitely you want to go through the old exams and, you know, the test bank that we have, and we have tests up on the top of your web page too. Gives you an idea. I keep emphasizing the point about when you're going through the test bank, cover up your answers, read the question, see if you could just answer the question by working through it without seeing the answers, and that will help you, like an open response types of answers, right, that you can work it out. Any questions about that generally? No? It's not meant to be stressful. I think people will finish in an hour or an hour and a half easily, but because you have that whole time, people tend to try to use the whole time just to keep going over. But what we found out in the past is that when you change your multiple choice answer, there'll be some multiple choice there, usually you're changing it to the wrong answer. And that happened even on the last test. A number of people marked a multiple choice answer, and they look at the Scantron, and they think about it, and they mark it wrong, and then you can see both answers on their test, and then you think, whoa, just kept with the first answer, right? So if you start changing answers, really think about why you're changing it, unless you didn't read all the answers. Any questions on the exam part, how that's going? It's in lab, right? But we still have lecture that week. Don't skip lecture that week. We're still moving on, right? And you won't be at a disadvantage at all if you have the Monday lab or the Tuesday lab or the Wednesday lab, because what we cover in lecture on that Tuesday won't be on those tests, right? So you're not at any disadvantage if you're taking it on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. We'll stop that content on that Thursday the week before. But there's a lot of content, right? Yes, there's a lot of content on this next exam. And then the final has a lot too. But the final, I have to turn those grades around relatively quick. So there might be a few open response questions, but there's not going to be much because we have to grade them all. That takes time. So most of the multiple choice, but that's worth a lot of points too. And it's comprehensive. But all the exams are kind of comprehensive, right? Because you add to it as you go along, as you the content wise. Okay, so just to bring that up again, we had people miss the quiz before. And, you know, they miss points just by not taking the quiz, which really helps your grade usually. So make sure you come next Tuesday for the quiz. Okay, so we are starting endocrine. And there's some content in here that's relatively, you know, very straightforward. And then I think this content begins to stress people out somewhat because there's a lot of different names, a lot of different compounds that people have to remember. And then it is a memory. There's a lot of memory to this next content because you just have to memorize the name and kind of where the target is, where the tissue, what tissue does it come from, what does it interact with. And so some people have, if you got time, it's really good to make little note cards and put down the hormone that we talk about and then write where does it come from, what's the target, and you know what might be regulating that hormone level. Is it glucose or is it sugar levels? You know, what is it that regulates that, right? So that will help you a lot with this next content. Some general terms, just to go over that. Autocrine action, auto, back by the same cell, paracrine, neighboring cells, right? And then an endocrine action means through the bloodstream. So when we talk about endocrine and hormones, something that goes into the bloodstream, travels in the bloodstream, then goes to target tissue. Neuroendocrine released from neural cells into the bloodstream, right? And we'll talk more about that when we talk about the pituitary gland. Okay, but get those down. And sometimes the confusion has come out in the past about, well, then if we're talking about a crustacean or an invertebrate, it's not blood, it's a hemolymph. It's the same thing, right? So a hormone that travels or a compound that travels in the hemolymph is an endocrine compound, right? Okay. So, and then pheromones, don't get confused with pheromones. We used to have that as a kind of like a true-false question on old exams, and people got that confused with a hormone. The pheromones in the air and the water, usually for the opposite sex. It's amazing when we talked about sensory systems. If you remember that moth that can sense levels of a pheromone that's so small, you know, in the air, you think about that content for finding that female, for example, is the concentration so small, but they can detect that, you know, parts per million or parts per billion in some sense. But the pheromones are not a hormone that's traveling in the media. It could be the air, like with insects, or a pheromone in the water, for example, between fish. Okay. If you looked at it on cell biology, if you remember, if you had cell, that you think about just looking at the cell, and then you can pretty much get an idea. Is this a cell that's very active, making steroid hormones, for example, or putting out peptides? Well, you would expect then a lot of what? Rough ER, right? Rough ER to be able to make those proteins. And if you have a lot of the ER too, you can think of steroid hormones that would be made. And then release out into the environment or into the animal's bloodstream. How are these? This is sometimes confusing. How are these hormones made if it's a steroid-based hormone that can go right through the bilipid membrane? In some cases, these fingers or with these vesicles, they can just kind of, I guess you'd say, branch off the end or slough off the end of their cells, and that then releases out into the bloodstream. So it's not so much like you might think of synaptic transmission where the vesicle fuses and exocytosis, but more or less sloughing off of the cell. We'll go through a little bit more of that too. Remember when we talked about neurons before? We talked about action potentials. What's the duration of an action potential like in your muscles, neuromuscular junction, or your sensory neurons? About a millisecond. Right? So about a millisecond up and down, maybe a little bit longer. But relatively, really fast, right? So remember all that? Sodium in, inactivation, potassium out, brings it back down. You know, kind of keep all that in your mind. But when we talk about a neuroendocrine cell, we usually think of the action potential. And this is the point I brought up before about it'd be really nice if you could measure the... No one won $100 yet. Still out there. The bet's still out there. You know, recording inside the presynaptic nerve terminals to get the shape of the action potential. So you could actually say, what is the shape in a mammalian preparation? But people have recorded in the nerve terminals of neuroendocrine cells. Usually they're quite large. They can actually take those out and culture those and record in those cells. And the shape of the action potential is quite long, or longer duration. And it kind of has that plateau that you see up there We haven't had the cardiac system yet. We haven't gone over that. But does anybody recognize that kind of shape, what that might relate to? If you've studied for MCAT tests or standardized exams, you might have had that shape, which relates to another tissue with a prolonged action potential. Anybody know where I'm going? No? It's like a Monday morning, early. We haven't had enough caffeine. Okay. Ventricular cells in the heart, you sometimes see that very wide action potential with a large plateau. It's usually on standardized exams, and that plateau is due to the calcium entry, but it's the same thing here too. So in the neuroendocrine cell, you see that the action potential is a lot longer in duration. That plateau is mostly due to a lot of calcium coming in. Now, why do we want a lot of calcium coming in? What does calcium do in the presynaptic neurofibrillary? Vesicle fusion, right? So longer duration of calcium coming in, then you can have more vesicular fusion events. So usually the neuroendocrine cells have a longer duration action potential, not as long, I don't want to confuse, not as long as that ventricular muscle cell that we'll be talking about when we get to the cardio system. That is hundreds of milliseconds, pretty much. This is longer than the normal neuronal action potential, but not 100 milliseconds. Okay. And we think about these, the whole process still with endocrine cells or neuroendocrine cells. What causes increases the sloughing off or vesicles to fuse is, again, calcium. Now, those vesicles or that fusion process, it doesn't know if that calcium came from extracellular calcium inside or an internal release of calcium. So if something causes the cell to release internal stores of calcium, that's going to cause the same response, that then these vesicles will fuse or release their content. So remember, the ER can store calcium, and like we talked about in the skeletal muscle, it's called sarcoplasmic reticulum. Think of it the same idea, basically. Release that calcium. If something triggers that calcium release, then that can activate that cell to release these compounds. Okay, and then some other terms. And so we're getting into, memorize these terms. Exocrine and endocrine glands. Exocrine, releasing that substance into, say, the saliva, like the salivary drop, or the endocrine gland, that's right around the blood vessel, straight into the bloodstream. So releasing it into the bloodstream, for example. And we'll talk more about the salivary secretions later on. There's a lot of modifications that go on in that, and you can probably imagine that regulation, too, is very important. It starts the digestive process in your mouth. We didn't get to digestion yet, but we'll come back to that also. But just to get these terms down, exocrine and endocrine. A lot of interesting history, and we have some really good courses here at UK on endocrinology. So we have a vertebrate endocrinology course. Jessica Centello teaches that. We have a neuroendocrine course that's taught by people over at the physiology department. Anybody have those courses? You had it? Good. Whatever you say is okay. Was it okay? So which one did you have? The
410.
Anybody take the neuroendocrine one? No one took the endocrine. All right, those are other courses that are out there. So pretty much really some interesting aspects. And when you think about hormonal regulation, growth, development, aging, all the problems that go on to sexual differentiation, there's a lot of interesting aspects with the endocrine system. Glucose regulation, osmoregulation, kidney function, hypertension. Wow, a lot of things, aspects of endocrine responses to think about with health and medicine. So some really good courses to take if you're interested. But some of the history was quite interesting. So this is relatively simple, but the idea of the compounds being released from some tissue, to be able to understand that, what they did is they took roosters, for example, and they took the testes out, and then they wouldn't develop as a rooster, you know, the comb and everything and the characteristics. But if they could take the testes out of one rooster and put it into a castrated rooster, and then all of a sudden it could change into the rooster. So they knew something was being released. So it's kind of interesting experimentally how they tested compounds that were released from a tissue that could then affect development. And that then opened up the idea of something traveling in the bloodstream. Much like what you might have read now about the heart lab, when you had the heart lab, some of you might have read some of that history. It was really quite interesting when they first stimulated the vagal nerve and realized that was slowing down the heart on a frog, for example, right? Acetylcholine, are we all on the same page? Remember that lab? fired. And acetylcholine released that they saw the heart was slowing down. They wondered, how is this happening? So what they actually did is they took the fluid from around that heart where they stimulated the vagal nerve, and they put that on a donor heart, another animal, without stimulating that vagal nerve, and they showed that that heart rate slowed down. So it was pretty interesting that something was being released. So they called it vega stuff. Vega stuff from the vagal nerve then turned out to be acetylcholine. Right? So it was kind of very interesting to think about compounds released from a tissue and then seeing how that compound worked on another preparation. Kind of interesting, historically, right? No? Maybe? Okay. So you think about comparative aspects. I mean, they were doing some wild things way back when to try to figure out what these compounds are that we just take for granted right now, right? And they had to do these experiments. I mean, to understand that, you might just think this is weird, but they took leeches, right? Leeches, the blood-sucking leech they put onto you, right? And that used to be a standard assay. Can you imagine that? Standard assay. They would open that up, and they would use that as a standard assay to find out if there was acetylcholine released from, you know, some tissue, or if the acetylcholine was present. They would grind it up and put it on the neuromuscular junction of the leech, which is cholinergic, unlike your crayfish or many of your insects, which is glutaminergic, right? And they would put that on to see if the muscle would contract. And that's the way that they could test if acetylcholine was in that tissue they would grind up. And actually, to understand if acetylcholine was in the brain of mammalian neurons or spinal cord, they used to grind up the spinal cord and take that homogenate and put it onto the leech neuromuscular junction to see if it would contract. Isn't that wild? And that was an assay to find out if acetylcholine was in that tissue. I mean, there's some really weird history. And then later on, you know, working it all out. But kind of interesting, because if put that on a crayfish preparation, doesn't really do anything. Or an insect, because that's glutaminergic, right? So, interesting. Just to kind of get you, yes, comparative phys. Viva comparative phys. All right, okay. So, interesting aspects with endocrine. And then these kind of assays, if you had to design an experiment, hint, hint, you might have to design an experiment. How would you test this? Who knows? I say these things, and then you study it, and then maybe it's not on the test, but it gets you thinking. It's the same thing went on with insects. They would take the head region of an insect, and even the brain out of an insect, and put it into another insect, and see what would happen, that they, you know, modified in some way, to find out if it would change, or if something was released from that tissue. So it's the same idea, but multiple ways that they would do these kind of experiments. Okay. And then over time, people found out what these compounds are. And quite interesting, like epinephrine, an amine, just to kind of get the idea, an amine. And then prostaglandins, too. You can see that this is more complex structure, but very important in understanding what they do in the body. And we won't go too much in depth in this, but it's quite interesting, too, about even changing your vascular system in development. It's very important how prostaglandins work, and we'll talk more about that when we talk about the cardiovascular system. But you've probably heard of people taking prostaglandin inhibitors, right? And that can be an aspect that's really important to think about if you have a developing fetus, for example, and you are just being born. So we'll talk more about that. Testosterone, these steroid molecules have this backbone structure. So steroids, if you see this kind of structure, you think steroid right away. I don't want you to have to memorize the structure with the hormone, which one's estrogen, which one's testosterone. There are some old exams out there from a faculty member we used to have a long time ago, and he had you memorize the structure of estrogen and testosterone and intermediates. This is not the biochem class. We're not going to have to do that. You might have to do that in the vertebrate endocrinology. Did you have to do that in endocrinology? Okay, so that course, you can save it for that, right? But the general idea here is this backbone structure of steroids. And that these are what? These molecules can go right through the bilipid membrane. So if testosterone's released or estrogen's released, think about that. It goes through all your cells. Isn't that amazing? It's going through all your cells, right? Because it's a steroid molecule and it can go right through the bilipid membranes. So this is why you can inject these substances like, you know, under your skin or IM in intramuscular, and they will diffuse throughout the whole body and they're then taken up in the bloodstream, but they go through all your cells. It's kind of like gamma rays, right? Right through you, right? So you think about these substances going through all your tissues, but why doesn't it work on all tissues? Because it needs a receptor, right? and we'll talk about receptors here in a little bit. So very interesting to think about. Some of these hormones that we're going to talk about, and we won't go too in-depth about this, but they have precursor structures, and then in the cell, they get modified, so they might cleave off particular sequences of amino acids, and then change their conformation to be in an active form. Some might, that might be released in the body, or an inactive form, and then it gets converted to an active form. We'll talk about that, particularly when we get to the renal system a little bit more, but just that you've kind of get the concept down. So what's made first in the cell, or what might be out there, could be a pro-hormone or a pre-structure that's not active, but after it changes its structure, then it becomes an active compound. And then other proteins are enzymes. Remember, all enzymes are proteins. And then they then might change that structure. So it depends on if that enzyme's present as well. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. So some just general concepts. I think we have this in our minds, especially from chapter one when we first talked about negative feedback. But a lot of these hormones have feedback processes, right, to regulate it in a homeostatic regulation. Some, we've talked about the general positive feedback. Which hormone was that again? Anybody remember? It's a standardized type of TEPS question too. Oxytocin, right? But most of the hormones we think about then are really with negative regulation, negative feedback loops. But these feedback loops get a little bit complicated. We'll go over a few common ones that we should know, but we don't want to go crazy with it because some of those, it's just too much to try to memorize. And it's, I just want you to get the general concept down in some of these specific pathways. All right. But the point here is that you can have some of these that go back in and maybe we'll have a negative feedback on the direct tissue, but then they might go up a different order that then activated that tissue. We'll talk about this with the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland when we get to that point. Okay. So there, it depends which textbook you might have had, but if you use the one that we're generally following, there's lots of tables in textbooks with these hormones, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's too much to memorize, right? So what we're going to do here is to go over the main ones that you should know. So these are the ones to star. If you have your book, highlight. And then we'll talk about those. And other ones that are, there's new ones being discovered all the time. We're not going to go through all that. But when you read some primary literature and you're going to say, oh, that's, in some of these newspaper article, they picked up on some hormones that were just discovered this last year. And it's amazing. There's new hormones being discovered. I mean, it's like, wow. Right? Isn't that amazing? You think everything's been known, but not so. So when you look at these tables, don't freak out. Let's go through some of the main ones. And some of these we'll come back to, like the GI ones, later when we talk about the GI system. We'll get to it because that's very important too. So some of those we'll come back to and talk more about in depth, but some of those now we're going to hit. And depending on your textbook, there's some typos on some of them. But this one typo that's in the textbook, I want to make sure that we get that down. Okay, so adrenal gland. I don't think we had an adrenal gland when we were at the outreach center, did we? We didn't. I don't think we had one there. But it's right above your kidney. And the adrenal gland is very interesting embryologically, the way it's formed in you, that there's actually the middle part of the adrenal gland, and then there's the outer part of the adrenal gland. So we call it adrenal medulla for the inside part, and the adrenal cortex for the outside part. The adrenal medulla actually comes from neural endocrine cells. It's neural crest in origin. It migrates from the developing nervous system. Isn't that amazing? It migrates on down in your body to then sit above your kidneys, and then the cortex tissue develops around it. So it's actually neural in origin. That's pretty cool. So what does the adrenal gland, how does that adrenal medulla relate to something that we talked about before in the nervous system? The last part before spring break? We hit it? If I scare you, what happens? What system is activated? Sympathetic, correct? Not parasympathetic. The sympathetic. And what happens is norepinephrine is released from your adrenal medulla, right? But also from sympathetic nerves that can go right onto your heart, increase your heart rate, but also releasing epinephrine from adrenal medulla that can then travel in your bloodstream as a hormone and then work on target tissue as well. Okay. So what happens, and you hear about these cases, if that migrating tissue might not go to the right location. And if it sometimes goes to different locations, have ectopic adrenal medullas. These ectopic adrenal medullas sometimes can be carcinogenic, cancer-producing. Most tumors are increasing secretion of whatever hormone that they're making or compound they're making. So think about if you had an adrenal medulla ectopically and it's increasing its production, it's a tumor, what's going to happen? Pretty bad, right? In the sense of epinephrine being released, hyperactivity, blood pressure, heart rate, everything happening. And so that can happen. But also these structures, like in the pituitary, are in a normal location where the adrenal is. It can also become cancerous, right? And so in that normal location, if it started to become cancerous and increased its production, think about that hormone going at very high levels and what would happen to the body responses, okay? So that's very interesting. And it's not just in humans, but in all animals, pretty much, these endocrine kind of responses. Veterinarians watch this, in particular breeds of animals, too, that are more susceptible to cancerous production. Okay, so the adrenal gland, remember two components, adrenal medulla, neuroendocrine cortex, and then what do these do? And we're going to come back to these structures, particularly the cortex, when we talk about the renal system. But for now, we do have to know this also. So the cortex, the outer region, releases aldosterone and cortisol. And cortisol is this, basically like a stress hormone also, right? Cortisol levels rise. They usually rise in you in a normal pattern. If you're in a normal sleep cycle, which is hard in college, I know. But if you're getting up at 6:30 or 7, trying to make it to class by 9 or 30 or so, your cortisol levels will rise in the morning, probably before you even get out of bed. It's that stress of just getting out of bed, getting that foot off the bed. And you know. And what does it do? It raises your glucose levels to be able to handle the stress of the day. So think of cortisol raising that levels of, say, glucose to handle stress. But what happens, remember what we talked about, GAS? You remember that compound, the acronym we mentioned for GAS, for the constant stress, right? And if you have constant stress, like sympathetic stress, right, constant test, anxiety, college, that we're all in, that if you continually had cortisol levels at high levels and you're trying to raise your glucose, but then you're depleting your glycogen stores and you can start to break down muscle mass. So you can start to have negative consequences of that constant stress. Cortisol levels help you handle, you know, low levels of stress, like you're hearing, you know, the dog chase you as you're jogging or biking, you know, get you going, right? So you can handle that in epinephrine, sympathetic system, but then also raising that glucose level so you can handle that stress for some time. But that constant level, to keep that up, could be detrimental to the body because where's that glucose coming from, right? Or keeping those energy stores. All right, aldosterone. We'll talk about more later, but this works on the kidneys to increase sodium reabsorption. So you make urine in your kidney, but if you can reabsorb, so we call that primary urine, it's not out of the body yet, primary urine that you're making in your kidney, but you reabsorb sodium, what's going to follow? Water. So you can take the water out of the primary urine and put that back in the body. So just to reemphasize that, reabsorption is different than absorption. When you eat some food, it's absorbed into your body. Reabsorption, it's already in your body, like the bloodstream, like the sodium, and the water goes and makes primary urine. You're reabsorbing it back into the bloodstream. All right, so try to keep those terms clear for the reabsorption. So if sodium's reabsorbed, water follows, what happens to your blood volume? It increases. What happens to your blood pressure? It increases, right? So you can imagine this is a target for looking at blood pressure regulation. And then maybe the adrenal cortex is hyperactive. And you make too much aldosterone, what's going to happen to blood pressure? It could be too high. So there are aspects to try to reduce that. One approach. Because it increases sodium retention. All right, and then we talked about cortisol and the adrenal medulla sympathetic system. So we kind of know that system already. The GI tract. A few of these we're going to hit in depth, but there's a lot here. The main ones that we're going to talk about is cholecystokinin, or CCK, secretin, and we'll talk about gastrin, all right, and gastrin-inhibiting peptide. There's a lot of hormones here, and there's just too much. I don't want you to bog down in memorizing all these. You can always go back and look up some of these hormones. But some of them that you really should know, particularly because they do appear on standardized exams too, CCK, secretin, gastrin-inhibiting peptide, and we'll talk more about those. But CCK works on your, increases enzyme production in secretion in your pancreatic cells and your gallbladder. So what they can do, if we don't know about it, we might have seen that at the outreach center, the gallbladder that was with the liver, the gallbladder stores bile. If you contract that little sac, it pushes the bile salts into your GI tract. And the main idea to remember that, those bile salts help you to emulsify fat, break up the fat in your diet after you go eat at Wendy's, break that up, and then so you can break it up into smaller molecules so you can absorb that fat, for example. All right. So if you had a fatty meal, the old exams have like a fatty meal, which ones would increase CCK secretion, you know, the bacon, eggs, right, that kind of thing, then that would actually cause an increase in the secretion of CCK. Okay. And secretin increases the bicarb secretion in the pancreatic cells, and that helps with the digestive process as well. Gastrin, well, that's at the bottom of the page here, too. And gastric will help with the digestive process. You might have heard in maybe a psychology class, if you've taken it, the different phases of digestion, but also Pavlov with the bell, right? Training the dogs, right? They're going to get a meal, and they have associative learning with the bell. So you ring the bell, you feed the dog, right? And you keep doing that, and then pretty soon you can just ring the bell, and the dog will already have stomach juices flowing. It's like when you smell the pancakes being cooked in the morning, right? You're already getting digestive processes going. So that was increasing the gastric acid that's going to be made to get ready for the digestive meal. So there's a cephalic phase to digestion, just the thought of that food, the smell of that food, the sensory perception, and then you're getting ready for that. But then that's being released into your stomach and it increases the HCL production. All right, we'll come back to those again, but just to hit those for now. So I know we're going through some tables, and this is a bit boring, but if you think about what they do, it's kind of exciting because they work on your body and how they work. Atrial-natriuretic peptide, this was really an interesting compound. People didn't believe it existed. People questioned the scientists that published this initially. And they said, this can't be. The heart's not releasing a hormone. What? The heart, you know, pumps, right? It's not to be releasing compounds. But so these people had really a big battle to try to prove this. And then finally, people realized this is true. And this was discovered up in Toronto, Canada. And interesting. So the atrium releases atrial natriuretic peptide. What does it do? It'll increase the salt and water excretion by the kidney. So what would cause ANP to rise, do you think? If it's going to try to have a negative feedback, it increases water release, increases urine production, basically, what would cause it to then happen? What would cause it to be released from the atrium in your heart? Isn't that weird? The heart is making this hormone that's releasing your bloodstream. If it's to increase urine production, decrease blood volume,
high blood pressure,
or actually stretching of the atrium, right? So that increased volume, stretching of the atrium, causes ANP to be released to then that negative feedback process. Oh, we got to get blood pressure down. We got to get the blood volume down. Let's increase urine production. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, think about if you go and you're drinking iced tea or a bunch of water, and you know it's not all going right through your GI tract, right, that quickly. You're not having to sit on the john and do a poop, right? But what happens? You have to urinate. So where'd that water go? It went into your bloodstream, and then went through your kidneys, and then your bladder, and then you had to go to the bathroom, right? So that meant it changed your, you know, it's regulating your blood volume. So that's pretty amazing when you think about it. It's pretty neat. And that happens pretty quick, right? You know, you drink a bunch of water. We're going to do some experiments. We didn't do the P lab yet, right? It's coming. Exciting. You're going to love it. No, most of the people don't like it. It's kind of fun. But it's just amazing how fast that your body regulates that. And from drinking that water, you can actually dilute yourself. We did talk about that before, right? Where some people on a hot day, summer day, drink too much water. Coaches have this issue. They're being trained now to kind of watch out for that. Competitions, crazy people doing these competitions, like how much water can you drink, right? And they die from drinking water. Water can be toxic because they drink so much, they dilute their salts in their body. They become hyponatremic, pass out. They can actually die from that. I think in Louisville, we had a case not that long ago. What was that, about 5 years ago or so, where some football players died because the coach told them to drink a bunch of water on a hot day. So a really bad situation. So just think about this. Yes, regulation is really important. Okay, so that's ANP. The kidney, we'll talk more about that as we go along, but increasing calcitrol increases blood calcium in bone formation, increases, what's really interesting is even in your stomach, or in your intestines, I should say, in your GI tract, increasing calcium absorption. Isn't it amazing to increase calcium uptake? So that's pretty amazing too. And that could raise calcium and then help with bone formation, for example. It's really quite interesting we talk about calcium regulation, because think if you break your arm, right, you break your bone, it heals back up. And that means that that calcium actually turns over. You're turning over quite a bit of the calcium in your bones and re-putting it back in there. And it's dynamic. If you add more weight to your bones, if you like put weight on your shoulder, backpack, and you carry it around, you will actually monitor your bones becoming heavier and thicker just because of the weight. And actually, heavy set people, for example, actually have larger bones and usually do not break their bones as easy as thinner people because their bones are thicker. And so, you know, that weight can change it. Now, think about somebody like on space, on the space station for a year. What happens to their bones? They actually decrease their bone mass and their thickness. And so when they come back to Earth on gravity, they have to rebuild that. And so NASA studies that, and their astronauts, and Russian astronauts, cosmonauts have been studied for this as well. So really quite interesting. And the kidneys also make something else. The kidneys make erythropoietin. Erythropoietin is very important. Erythropoietin, it increases your red blood cells. So if you go to high altitude, for example, and you have low oxygen, your kidneys will actually start to increase erythropoietin production. And this is kind of interesting. What's the mechanism there in the kidneys? How do those cells sense, I've got to increase erythropoietin? Is it, you know, low oxygen levels? They sense this oxygen? So it's really quite interesting to think about, as well as inside of your bone, increasing erythropoietin production. You might have heard of this compound because this compound has been used in bad ways, right? Blood doping, for example. Athletes were shooting in erythropoietin because it's a natural substance, right? And you could increase your red blood cell count to increase your oxygen carrying capacity. So then you could compete better. You've probably heard about this kind of thing, like with Lance Armstrong, the biking races that go on in Europe. One year, I think 3 people died on Tour de France because of blood doping. And when they actually got them into the hospital, they said their blood was like just a thick, like molasses syrup, because they had too many red blood cells. And it actually then clogged up their capillary bed. So too much, not a good idea. They're beginning to test this now in Olympics, you know, testing, because they're worried about people blood doping. But some people have a naturally kind of a higher erythropoietin levels. Or they might train. What's wrong with training, which a lot of our athletes do, training in Colorado at Cold Spring, what's the name of it? Cold Springs? Not Cold Springs. Colorado Springs, yes. Training facility that's in Colorado Springs. And why are they training there? Altitude, right? If you train up at altitude, you naturally increase your red blood cell count, right? And then you compete at a race or something that's more at a sea level, like what happened in Brazil, they have a higher red blood cell count, naturally, because that's where they're training. So you can see the issues. How do they know if somebody didn't blood dope versus training in Colorado Springs, or doing Colorado Springs as well as blood doping, right? So these are some of the issues out there. So this is really something to think about. So what happens if you have kidney failure? How could you be anemic with kidney failure? Or kidney problems with your kidney? Maybe not total failure, but you're having a disease in your kidney. Something's not working right. Maybe your erythropoietin production's down, right? So people that are on dialysis, for example, because their kidneys aren't working right, they monitor their red blood cell count. You might wonder, why are they monitoring red blood cell count? I'm worried about, you know, sodium balance, potassium balance, and all that. Why are they measuring red blood cell count? The reason is this, because if you decrease your erythropoietin from your kidneys, your red blood cells aren't at the level they should be, and you can decrease your red blood cells. So somebody with kidney problems might be getting erythropoietin injections to keep their red blood cell count up. So it's interesting to think about. And renin we'll talk about a little bit later, but it's from the kidney also, and it converts this angiotensinogen to angiotensin II. Angiotensin II is a potent vasoconstrictor. So what's that going to do to blood pressure? It vasoconstricts. It's going to raise blood pressure, right? And it can also go back, angiotensin II, and work on the adrenal cortex, which then causes aldosterone to be released, which then does what? Increases blood pressure, too. So here's multiple ways that the kidney can regulate its blood pressure with releasing renin that increases basically downstream angiotensin II, which then can cause vasoconstriction, but also work on the adrenal cortex to increase release of aldosterone that also increases sodium resorption that also increases blood pressure. So kind of interesting, this tissue then having multiple ways to regulate blood pressure, which then changes urine production as well. We'll go more into the details of the mechanisms of this. It's quite interesting. And the different cell types in the kidney for regulation. When we get into the reproductive tissue, it's quite interesting as well. Some aspects that we'll get into a little bit later about talking about these different hormones, steroids. But do remember that estrogen, estradiol, increased development of female reproduction. Males have some estradiol too, just like females have testosterone as well, but at different levels. Okay, and the secondary sexual characteristics all related with estrogen, puberty, for example. And we'll talk about where these hormones are released, like from the follicle for estrogen and the corpus luteum, primarily then with progesterone and relaxin. And progesterone is important as well for growth of the uterine lining, mammary glands, behavior. And when you think about the birth control pill, it used to be very high in estrogen. Anybody know some of the history? Did you read any history in vertebrate endocrinology? Did they go over some of the history or anything like that? Nothing. So it's really quite interesting. It's got some bad history in the development of the pill, particularly the companies that were developing that. They actually went to Puerto Rico, and they used the Puerto Ricans pretty much as guinea pigs in understanding how the pill would work, had them sign waivers, and the initial pill was actually very high in estrogen. What does estrogen do if you take it really at high levels? Well, it messes up the reproductive cycle, as we'll talk about, but also some latent types of tissue that was estrogen sensitive. So it caused a lot of cancers. It caused uterine cancers, it caused breast cancers, and these people that were initially given this high estrogen level, and they didn't get compensated for it because they signed their waivers. From those studies, you can thank a lot of the Puerto Ricans that developed cancer from development of the pill to help other people, but it was really kind of a sad story. It's kind of like coal mining in eastern Kentucky a long time ago with coal mines that took land out from underneath people. And so it's an interesting history if you want to follow up on that. But from those studies, they realized they shouldn't have such high levels of estrogen. They should have some progesterone in there. And if anybody kind of knows about this, the pill, for example, you might take it for a good while and then you're off sometime to get your body back in the natural cycle, and then you go back on the pill if you're taking the pill, and to kind of get your body back into its normal regulation. So there's some really interesting ways that have developed now to take birth control pills, but the levels now that people take are regulated pretty carefully and well managed. But the history of this does have some bad history. So also, estrogen, what happens? What does estrogen also do? Let's see if it's on here. It's not on here right now. But you hear about older people, particularly females, they have osteoporosis, right? Their bones start to break down. So what do they take? Estrogen. You might have heard that. Talk to your grandparents, grandma, or depending on your age, your mom. And if they're on, estrogen for osteoporosis. But what happened when they started giving their estrogen? Breast cancer started to be developed. Uterine cancer started to be developed. Because their estrogen levels were low, and the tissue wasn't so, they didn't have those higher levels, and all of a sudden they're getting injections with these higher levels to build their bone back up, then boom, they got cancers. Now, how about some of the people that had breast cancer, for example, and they might have removed the breast, right? And they say, okay, now the cancer's gone, but now they're older, and they're getting osteoporosis, so what do they give them? Estrogen. But what if that breast cancer might have metastasized, but kind of dormant? It's not getting the high levels, but, low level. Then all of a sudden they got the estrogen injections, and now these metastasized tumors that weren't so active become active. So a lot of older people that were getting estrogen injections for osteoporosis that had breast cancer in the past were in remission. All of a sudden it came back to them, and so there's some bad history with that too. But now people are aware of that. But it's still going on. You still hear of cases where a woman might have had breast cancer. It was taken care of. They thought they were in remission. They're older. They're getting osteoporosis. And somebody gave them or prescribed estrogen for them. And then they develop cancers. So that's still going on today. So it's really something to pay attention to and think about as well. But you get the idea of why this is really important to understand it all together. And endocrine is so amazing. Okay, I know there's a lot to these tables, but we just kind of go through it, and then we'll go through the tissues as we go along later on. Pancreas, very important, particularly for glucose regulation, glucagon and insulin, primary the two. How to remember which cell types? Did we talk about those before? No? I can't remember what we said and what we did. But the way to remember what cell types these come from, when we talk about it, is later in the pancreas. It's on standardized exams, too. Glucagon, alpha cells. Glucagon, alpha cells. Right? You can remember that with the name. Insulin from beta cells. Okay, so you'll never forget it. Glucagon, alpha cells. So if you have to guess on a multiple choice exam, right, which cell types does glucagon or insulin come from? Alpha cells for glucagon. All right, and what do these hormones do? Glucagon raises blood glucose. People get this confused sometimes. So it raises blood glucose. Insulin decreases blood glucose by what? Getting glucose to be taken up into tissue. Your major tissue that takes up glucose is skeletal muscle. Your skeletal muscle is a major sink for glucose. And if you have extra glucose around, then what happens in that muscle cell, in the skeletal muscle? It gets turned into glycogen. And you can then store glycogen in your skeletal muscle. And then when you need that glucose, you break down that glycogen. It can go into glucose and be used inside the muscle cell, but it can also be released back into the bloodstream. So your skeletal muscle is very important for glucose regulation as well. It's a sink of the glucose. All right? And we'll come back to these a bit later, but right now then, glucagon, alpha cells, insulin, beta cells. And very interesting, if anybody's, knows somebody that's a diabetic, for example, and how they can control their glucose, so many interesting compounds out there to understand regulating glucose levels. So it's fast-acting insulin, slow-acting insulin, or really slow-acting insulin to keep that glucose levels regulated. So very important. And parathyroid glands, just like they mentioned, para. They're around the thyroid. So your thyroid's in your neck, right? And the parathyroid are tissues that's in your thyroid gland. It's around your thyroid. It's in your thyroid. And they help with calcium regulation. Now, you might have heard of people, it was kind of a fad at a time, when people had like hypermetabolism, they thought, oh, you have too much thyroid. So they would cut out the thyroid tissue. Are actually use compounds that would, that's okay. And they would actually use compounds that would destroy the thyroid. They would use radioactive iodine, for example, and it would actually destroy that tissue. But the problem was, when people took out the thyroid gland, sometimes they would remove the parathyroid gland, and then they would have calcium problems. The parathyroid gland is really quite interesting because embryologically, if you ever get a chance to take an embryology course or just pick up a book, read it on your own, a lot of content you can understand by yourself. Don't get somebody up here yapping at you. But you can, you know, just read about it. Really interesting because when it develops embryologically, it basically forms this kind of groups of three pairs of tissue on your thyroid. But sometimes it doesn't develop like that. Instead, it might just develop as a group. And then if you remove the thyroid, the tissue, to reduce this hypermetabolism, what happened? You might have removed the parathyroid gland that didn't have it really spread out, but you might have removed the whole chunk of it, and then you have calcium balance problems. And so then your bones start to have osteoporosis. So then what do you do? Inject the estrogen. You see the cycle is a mess, right? So it's interesting to think about. All right. Pineal, we'll talk more about that later. Melatonin, very important for circadian patterns, and we'll get more involved with that, but also gonadal development is important with melatonin. Pituitary, we're going to go through that quite a bit. That's a whole other table. Placenta, chorionic gonadotropin, important, right? That's your birth control, your check if you're pregnant, for example, because it goes up very quickly, so the little blue X or whatever they have nowadays. If you're checking that, you're probably using an assay for chorionic gonadotropin. All right. And angiotensin II, we talked a little bit about already. Increases vasoconstriction, but also works to increase on the adrenal cortex to increase aldosterone release. Okay. And then the male hormones, testosterone, mammalian regression factor. We'll talk about development of the reproductive system a little bit later. But the Leydig cells are like the follicle in the sense of releasing the follicle for estrogen, the testes for testosterone, all right? In the Leydig cells in the testes with testosterone. Sertoli cells, we'll get more involved in that in a little bit, but they can decrease this follicle-stimulating hormone. Oh, I do want to mention, when we go back a little bit, like these gastrointestinal tract, and you think about all these hormones, and you can hear these like gastrin or gastrin-releasing peptide or even CCK or secretin, and you think, oh, I've got those now, but then all of a sudden I'm reading this paper and they're in the brain. They're in the nervous tissue. What? I thought they had to do with the GI tract. What are you talking about? Why is it in the brain? It's because they were first described and discovered with the GI system, but these compounds are also found in other tissues. They do have staining in the brain for like CCK and secretin and gastrin inhibitory peptide, but they don't know exactly what they're doing, but they're there. But don't freak out if you hear that they're there. It's just that they were first described and classified with the gastrointestinal system, but they do occur in other tissues as well. And people are still trying to figure out what some of these hormones do in other tissues. It's quite interesting. All right, and the thyroid gland, well, that's a whole other aspect too. Regulation, we'll talk more about that. Won't talk too much about the thymus gland, but more with the immune system and lymphocytes. Interesting diseases with the thymus gland. I'm hoping to get through this endocrine chapter and some of these main aspects, and then we have a slide, I already put it online on the PowerPoints on the bottom of your webpage. Endocrine problems, because it relates more to human problems. Also veterinarian care. Quite interesting to think about the disease cases, because I think it helps to understand what it's doing as a mechanism, right? So it'd be interesting to go over. Thyroid gland, as I mentioned, thyroid hormones. So like thyroxine and what we refer to as really T4 and T3. Triiodothyronine, T3, and thyroxine is T4. And we'll get into that a little bit later, but those are very important in development. If you do not have thyroid hormone as growing up through puberty, you will have stunted growth. And quite interesting, and also the thyroid hormone is very interesting on a comparative aspect. It's important for reabsorption of the tail of a tadpole and developing the legs, for example, on a tadpole to a frog. So thyroid hormone, very important in development. and for developing reproductive tissue as well. So you might, we'll go through that when we get into the disease states of the endocrine system. Okay, so that's pretty much a lot of the tissues we've talked about. Parathyroid cells that are around the thyroid gland, these parathyricular cells, and also the calcitonin that's released. So you get parathyroid hormone from the parathyroid glands. What do? Break down bone, increase your calcium levels. Calcitonin will put, how to remember this? I know it's corny. Corny things you'll remember, right? Calcitonin, tone in the bones. So tones in the bone. Increases calcium into the bone, right? So calcitonin, tone, think of tone, okay? And that will help maybe memorize these compounds. Okay. Caffeine. So if you look at these cells, you can tell which ones are really active. You're having a lot of ER, secreting vesicles, fusion. Then you could think about that's a very active cell. All right. And when we think about these neuroendocrine cells and releasing into the bloodstream, we're going to go through a little bit of that. Quite interesting because these compounds could be made in the neural tissue far away from where it's being released. Okay, so we're going to talk about some of these for the pituitary, where the hormones are made in the hypothalamus but released in the pituitary because their axons go down into the pituitary and then are released into the bloodstream. And then they can work on target tissue. All right, so now we can kind of go through some of these tissues that we've talked about, these hormones. Let's think about the pituitary. The main points to remember here is there's two regions to the pituitary. There's the anterior region and the posterior region. The posterior region of the pituitary is just a extension of the brain, basically. All right, so think of the brain just extending itself out, making the posterior pituitary. But the cell bodies in the hypothalamus. Now, maybe in your endocrine class, you had to memorize where these different cell bodies were. I just want you to remember that it's in the hypothalamus. I'm not worried that you memorize the different locations in the hypothalamus, all right? Just the hypothalamus. But their axons project into the posterior pituitary. So the posterior pituitary, this extension of the brain. Now, what's interesting is the bloodstream's right there. And it can be released right into the bloodstream. Two main hormones to remember for the posterior pituitary. Oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone are vasopressin. Okay, so antidiuretic, what does antidiuretic mean? Diuresis, urine production, right? So antidiuresis, decreasing urine production, right? And oxytocin we've talked about for like milk letdown, bonding hormone, contraction of the uterus, for example, child delivery, right? You get Pitocin, the injection increases contractions for a woman in labor, for example. We'll talk a little bit more about the PAR intermedia. This is melanocyte-stimulating hormone. In some animals, this is actually very enlarged because of the melanocytes that are active, you know, for skin color, for example, or color on the lizard, for example, can change quite a bit. And this is more active in some animals than, say, for us. Now, the anterior pituitary, this is where we have a list of hormones that we have to remember. All right? And it's quite interesting because the releasing hormones, like we'll talk about in a little bit, they are released from the hypothalamus into the bloodstream, carried in the bloodstream to the anterior pituitary, can cause the anterior pituitary to change their release, and then those then travel in the bloodstream. So this is where we talk about this negative feedback processes, that we could have negative feedback directly back on the anterior pituitary, or we could have negative feedback onto the hypothalamus that release the releasing hormones to then activate on the anterior pituitary. So whenever you hear a releasing hormone, this is where it gets confusing. It might be like thyroid releasing hormone. And you think, oh, thyroid, or, you know, something. And whatever the releasing hormone. But just think hypothalamus right away. All right? So releasing hormone, hypothalamus. Not anterior pituitary. Think of the hypothalamus. All right? And then we get to the anterior pituitary, and now there's a list of hormones that we should remember. growth hormone, prolactin, thyrotropin, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, adrenocorticotropin, all released from the anterior pituitary. Something to remember before we talk about reproductive hormones, that follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are not just in females. There's also in males. All right? But they're just named this because of their first description of what they did. So they named them follicle-stimulating hormone because it stimulates the follicle, or luteinizing hormone because it stimulates the corpus luteum. But they also work in male tissue as well. And we'll get to that a little bit later. Okay. So now we get into these hypothalamic hormones and what they do. So there's a lot here, but don't freak out. The names really help you quite a bit. Corticotropin releasing hormone, CRH. Now you probably should try to remember the abbreviations for these hormones. I try to remember on the exams to give you the whole name and maybe the abbreviation too, but standardized exams don't always do that. So if you're going to take standardized exams, now's a good time to start to memorize these abbreviations that they give. Like CRH, corticotropin releasing hormone. Well, what does it mean? It's going to then stimulate the release of ACTH. And we'll talk about that as we go along. So these peptides, amino acids, growth hormone releasing hormone, GRH. Well, they're going to stimulate the growth hormone release. Gonadotropin releasing hormones, kind of a little bit of a tricky name here, but gonadotropins are gonads, right? The gonads, the testes and the ovaries, then gonad-releasing hormone will stimulate FSH and LH from the anterior pituitary. Okay, and then we'll talk more about what they do down the line. And then you have thyroid-releasing hormone or thyroid-stimulating hormone, but thyroid-releasing hormone seems to be what's usually referred to, and that stimulates in the thyroid. It stimulates the releasing of thyroid hormone, and then it works in the thyroid gland. But we'll get into some of those cycles in a little bit later. And then another one that we probably should remember is the prolactin-inhibiting hormone and somatostatin-inhibiting hormone. And vertebrate endocrinology, did you give a different name to this? Do you remember? Prolactin-inhibiting hormone? No, because it's thought to be dopamine. Actually, okay. So maybe still keep with this classification. Okay. Peptides, right? Versus steroids. Peptides, amino acids, relatively small, not really large, substances, but then released and traveled in the blood. What's really interesting about let's look at this picture. I thought we had a better picture. Let's see. Well, this one. What's really interesting about the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus for these releasing hormones, the way the circulatory system is related here, and we'll get to the kidney, and it's again fascinating. So think of the circulatory system, bloodstream. It actually perfuses the hypothalamus, and guess what the next tissue is that it perfuses? Anterior pituitary. Isn't that cool? So the blood vessels, the capillary beds that go through the hypothalamus, that collect the releasing hormones, the next tissue that it perfuses is the anterior pituitary. So does the concentration have to be that high of these releasing hormones? If the next tissue where it works on it has these receptors, is it what it's going to get to? Right? Because after it goes, passes the anterior pituitary, and it goes into the whole bloodstream, about 5 liters, what's happened to the concentration of that hormone? It's really dropped, right? So when it recycles back around, you don't have that much that's going to hit the anterior pituitary. But if the next tissue from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary is right in that capillary line, then they're going to sense the highest concentration before it gets diluted. It's really quite neat to think about. All right. So the circulatory system along with this, and when we talk about even the GI system, it's really quite interesting because you think of the compounds that are released from the intestine, what the intestine senses can then the next tissue in line is the pancreas and can release other substances or right onto the gallbladder, so secretin and CCK can work on the gallbladder to cause release of bile salts. So it's pretty neat, right? It's kind of interesting that it's all working together. So just kind of think of that in mind. Okay, these hormones that are released from the anterior pituitary, and what do? So let's think about adrenal corticotropin hormone. ACTH, as an abbreviation, works on the adrenal cortex. And so the adrenal medulla, epinephrine, norepinephrine, sympathetic, adrenal cortex. Think about stress hormones, glucocorticoids, glucose levels. So glucocorticoids, glucose levels, like cortisol would be the one you remember. But also, what else is from the adrenal cortex? I know we just covered it. Aldosterone, right? And so you think about these substances that then are released from the adrenal cortex. So adrenal cortex, ACTH, works on the adrenal cortex and then can cause release, say, like of cortisol and aldosterone. FSH, LH, gonads, follicle stimulating, that's easy to remember, right? Follicle. And luteinizing hormone, the corpus luteum, but also in males, testicular cells, and in males for follicle-stimulating hormone on sperm production. So think about ovaries for production. And we'll talk more about this in detail about what follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone does. But remember, they both work in males and females, released from the anterior pituitary. What caused their release? Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, right? And then you get thyroid-stimulating hormone. And this is interesting because thyroid-releasing hormone, right, from the hypothalamus onto the anterior pituitary, then the anterior pituitary releases thyroid-stimulating hormone. What does that do? The next tissue, the thyroid gland. What does the thyroid gland do? Releases T3, T4, and then that works on the body. But if you raise T3, T4, then you can have a feedback back on the thyroid, have feedback back on the anterior pituitary, and have feedback back on the hypothalamus. Really quite interesting, right? So a lot there to try to think about. And then we'll try to go through these tissues. So here's your feedback mechanisms that you can think about, depending on where the feedback is. Thyroid's quite interesting because if you work on the thyroid-stimulating hormone, think about the thyroid and then releasing T3, T4, and then feedback back on these systems as well. So kind of just the general mindset. If you had a open response question, how could you regulate thyroid hormone? And this is interesting. Some people find have high metabolism, so they think, oh, thyroid gland, measure thyroid. And you think, oh, it's a thyroid. Maybe you got a thyroid tumor. Take out the thyroid, and you take out some of it, so the thyroid hormone goes down. But then it goes back up again. Uh-oh. Why is it back up? I took out from the thyroid. Well, the tumor wasn't there. The tumor was the next order up, right? Maybe the anterior pituitary. It can happen, and even less common, but it could be in the hypothalamus. And then what happens? Thyroid-releasing hormone, a thyroid, then working on the anterior pituitary, so maybe it's the anterior pituitary, not the thyroid, right? So something that's driving that tissue. So they have to work that out. It's kind of interesting. There, we had a student once that was in animal physiology. She went into medicine. She did some rotations. She could not stand the sight of blood or needles. Passed out all the time with it. So that was a horrible experience for her. She was wondering about staying in medicine. She was thinking about psychiatry. And then she really found her interest and passion in pediatric endocrinology. And she went to NYU. And she's studying up at NYU. She's a clinician up there now. But she loves this field of pediatric endocrinology for developmental issues, and it's really kind of an exploratory, investigative process to try to think about these negative feedbacks, and she just loves this field. So it's really quite interesting. If you don't like blood and guts, for example, or trauma, think about other aspects that you can get into, and that's very important as well. So there are endocrinologists. There's even specialist endocrinologists for like glucose regulation, or pediatrics, or even older age now. So you can specialize in the aspects of endocrinology. Okay. We're getting there. And then, so the posterior pituitary, we talked about two main hormones, ADH, antidiuretic, and then oxytocin for milk ejection and for uterine contractions, just like we talked about with parturation. You can inject Pitocin, increases uterine contraction to help with child delivery. Remember, that's an example of positive feedback system. A woman, for example, that might hear that just had child delivery, they might hear a baby crying in another room. That can cause milk letdown and cause some issues too. So it's very interesting with sound and thinking of getting ready for milk letdown, but it could be other babies, not your own baby. So that's kind of interesting to think about. ADH, antidiuretic hormone, working on the kidneys to increase sodium reabsorption. If you increase sodium reabsorption, you don't make as much urine because you reabsorb sodium back in the blood. What's going to follow from the primary urine? Water. So you decrease your urine production. Alcohol, right? If you're over 21, I'm sure you haven't experienced it until you're over 21. But if you drink alcohol, for example, you usually have to go to the bathroom. And then like beer, for example, it's not just the volume of the beer, the fluid that you're drinking, but it actually inhibits ADH. So if you inhibit ADH, you've inhibited the sodium reabsorption. You then make more primary urine. You increase your diuresis, and that's why you go to the bathroom. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to think about, too. Okay. Steroid hormones, and really quite interesting, because when I was a student and took an endocrinology course, which was interesting, but there's been so much from that time, back 30 years ago, 4 years ago, I think, I took an endocrinology course, 35 maybe. The books have changed quite a bit, and a lot of new hormones out there. But when I was taking that class, steroid hormones only worked inside the cytoplasm. Steroid hormones went across the plasma membrane and bound to a receptor inside the cytoplasm. And then they worked on like gene regulation, like for testosterone or estrogen. Then they discovered, and it was a serendipitous type of discovery. It was actually people looking at blood pressure changes, and they found out that they were, like you could inject testosterone, estrogen, and they would see whatever the response was that's being measured. They would see the response that's kind of quick, and then they would see this response that was took minutes or hours to have an effect. And everybody thought, okay, this fast effect was just kind of a fluke, right? But then when they do controls, like if you inject saline with the hormone, right, testosterone, estrogen, then what do you have to do as a control? You got to just inject the saline by itself, the carrier, right, without the hormone. But then when they were injecting just the saline, they didn't see that initial change. And they thought, controls don't show that initial change, and they're not showing the long-term change. But now if I put a hormone like estrogen or testosterone in there, or cortisol, then I see this rapid change, and then this long-term change. Well, how can that be? Because I'm not getting it on the controlled injections. And then they started thinking, could there be something that would work really fast with steroid hormones that we haven't thought about? And then later on, they found out there are receptors on the cell surface that work very quickly with steroid hormones. And now they've basically discovered those for estrogen, testosterone, and other steroid hormones as well. So you have, not only are they lipid-soluble, but there's receptors on the cell surface that can mediate rapid responses like with testosterone, estrogen, and steroid hormones. And so that was a big discovery. Lots of interesting things change in time, and people are looking at blockers for these, and agonists, antagonists, really quite interesting. But then many of these are going right across the bilipid membrane, into the cells, binding to a cytoplasmic receptor, and then working, say, on gene regulation to then make a protein, for example, in this cascade, and having more long-term effects. But that takes a longer phase for it to really happen, right? Because you have to turn on protein transcription, translation, all that good stuff. Okay, so there are receptors that are mediated on the cell surface for lipid-soluble hormones, as well as lipid-insoluble hormones. So if we talk about peptides, generally they're not going right to the bilipid membrane, right? The peptides are binding to these receptors on the cell surface and having an action either through some second messenger cascades, and there's many of those that we will talk about, some of those main ones. And we're going to have to stop here in a second, but think about some of the main aspects, the differences, but given also what I just said about surface receptors. Lipid-soluble and insoluble. So lipid-insoluble peptides, right? Catecholamines, lipid-soluble steroid hormones, have that cholesterol backbone, and thyroid hormones fit in that. But responses that last, if you're turning on gene regulation, lasting a long term. This is the main point, long term. We're lipid-insoluble, binding that receptor right off the bat, fast effects, seconds, minutes, okay? Okay, we will wrap up endocrine on Thursday, hit the main points. I hope we can get through the rest of this PowerPoints if you want to. Kind of flip through your PowerPoints, kind of get familiar with it. We're going to go a little fast, but now is really a time to start with your note cards. There's a lot to remember as you're kind of waking up to now. Spring break's over. 6 more weeks, you can do it. Think of that little dog on that treadmill going. If you didn't pick up your quizzes, I have them up here. Quiz number 3, our makeup exams, stuff like that.
Hi. Can I get my quiz for Victoria?
Yeah,
last name. Yes, thank you.
Did you get yours?
All right, gotcha. I'll take a towel. So what exact chapters is this next exam?
Oh, everything since... It's really comprehensive.
Right.
But everything since the last exam. And then we're going to have cardio.
Like 6, 7.
Yes. So we finished week of sensory, right? And then the autonomic nervous system, behavior, endocrine. And the next chapter we are into is cardio. So there's a lot.
Right. Thank you.
You got your...
I got my quiz back. Looking for that. Makeup exam?
Oh, yeah.
It's Gidry. G-U-I. G-U-I-Y.
Did I give it back to you already? Did I grade it and give it back to you right away?
No. I remember handing it to you and then leaving.
Okay, I got these two.
I took it a little bit earlier.
Okay. I will bring it on Thursday.
Okay.
Okay, awesome. But definitely remind me, okay?
Thank you.
Okay.